Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette, Part 1, for Thursday, December 19th, 2024. Marching Illini eager for Citrus Bowl excursion. For about 400 University of Illinois students, winter break will be cut short for a two-day bus ride to Florida. But the Marching Illini don't seem too upset about the long haul to Orlando for the Christmas Citrus Bowl. I think a lot of people would say this. That's where you make your memories in band, is in the travel, said senior and trumpet section leader Ty Vendroska. We joke and say you get a vacation with your friends, but that's truly what it is. Senior and clarinet section leader Josie LaPapa plans to bring along her applications to audiology school, so she isn't worried about filling the time either. I'm excited to spend time with my friends. A lot of the time it's like the journey that's more fun than the actual event, LaPapa said. For senior and piccolo section leader Maddie Kokolowski, travel cross country is no big deal after plenty of long road trips with her family. It's always been such a cool opportunity to drive across the country and see things you wouldn't see on a plane ride, she said. The trip to the Citrus Bowl will not be the first time most seniors have traveled with the Marching Illini, so they already know what they're in for. I'm so incredibly excited for the opportunity to perform and share our Illini spirit with so many people, whether they've watched the Marching Illini for years or this is their first time seeing us, whether it's in person or on TV. The chance to showcase our hard work, great energy, and represent the University of Illinois on a national level is a huge deal, Kokolowski said. Well, band members are focusing on finals. Band director Barry Hauser is working out the logistics to get more than 400 people, 8 charter coaches, and a 126-foot equipment truck down to the Citrus Bowl. The itinerary includes 2 days of travel each direction and 2 days of supporting the Illini football team down in Orlando. On December 30th, Hauser said the band will participate in the Citrus Bowl pep rally and an alumni event. December 31st is game day, so the band will participate in a Citrus Bowl fan fest and then put on pregame and halftime shows before, of course, celebrating New Year's Eve. Hauser said he was excited that the Division of Intercollegiate Athletics had enough of a budget that, along with some Marching Illini funds, he could bring the entire band. The fact that we get to take everybody, I think, is just a fantastic thing and a great experience for students, Hauser said. Some students who live farther away will fly or drive in to meet the rest in Orlando, but Hauser said the majority live in or around Illinois and will convene in Champaign-Urbana to ride the buses. That means he has to coordinate lists for who is on each of those 8 buses and who is in which room across 3 hotels, plus who is getting fed what throughout the trip. I'm still very much in the thick, but I'm seeing light at the end of the tunnel of all this coming together, he said. The band will only have about 5 minutes on the field for a pregame show and another 5 at halftime, so Hauser worked out a very abbreviated version of each to make sure fans could hear some Illini classics. We'll get to see the 3-in-1 in Camping World Stadium instead of Memorial Stadium, he said. We've kind of filtered it down to the things that represent us the most, LaPapa said. I think we're going to be able to effectively get across everything we want to, but I'll definitely be interesting to see how that plays out. Either way, LaPapa said she is grateful and excited to have this experience in her senior year. We have a really positive and welcoming culture within Marching Illini, where it really does feel like a family, she said. So even though I'm away from my family for part of that winter break, I'm just with my band family instead. Vendroska said he's looking forward to showing off the band's skills to an audience it doesn't usually get to perform for, especially one that will likely be full of fans. Florida is like the prime retirement spot for anyone in Illinois, so it's fun because we have a pretty large fan and alumni base down there already. He said, I always love meeting alumni, getting to share with them the experiences I'm having now, and comparing them to experiences that they had then. Friday vote to select Chancellor Search Committee. A month after University of Illinois Chancellor Robert Jones announced his plans to step down this summer, the team that will select his successor is beginning to come together. The U of I Senate is scheduled to vote on members of the selection committee through the end of the day Friday. Faculty, staff, and students have had since December 3rd to nominate people they think should be part of the committee, while the Senate finalized the committee's composition. By the time the nomination window was closed, the Office of Senate had received 228 submissions. The Office Director, Jenny Rother, said some individuals were nominated more than once. Submissions included a short bio about each individual. When the committee is finalized, it will include 7 faculty members, with 1 chosen as chair, 3 student members, 2 academic professional members, 1 civil service member, and 1 dean or director. In order to represent as much of the university as possible, no more than 2 faculty members can come from the same college or similar division, and none of the students can come from the same college or unit. At least one of the students has to be an undergraduate, and another has to be a graduate or professional student. Additionally, the committee must comply with a section of the University of Illinois Act that states that when a chancellor search committee is formed, there shall be minority representation, including women, on that search committee. The committee will advise President Tim Killeen in the selection process. Members will be announced once the Senate has finished voting and confirming its results. U of I System Vice President of External Relations, Adrienne Nazan, said the responses are in from search firms the university is considering working with, but a final selection has not been made. Nazan said more details will be confirmed around the middle of January. Jones intends to step down at the end of June 2025, giving U of I around 6 months to determine a new chancellor. Top of the morning. Something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Thanks to the many Illinois basketball fans who told us about their attendance at every home upset of number 1 ranked teams, Jim Doyle's experience, however, stands out. I'll bet I'm the only one who went from the worst seat in the house to the best. For the 1979 upset of Michigan State, Doyle and his brothers scored last-minute tickets and sat in the top row of the assembly hall. He had better seats for the 2004 win against Wake Forest. When Indiana visited in 2013, Doyle was knee-deep in his job as scoreboard operator, with a perfect half-court seat at the scorer's table. After Tyler Griffey's last-second lay-in, the fans rushed the court and the referees rushed the scorer's table to see the replay and confirm the shot beat the buzzer. It did, and Doyle survived the chaos. He was hoping the same scene played out last Saturday when he settled into his normal seat against Tennessee. He's no longer scoreboard operator. The game was every bit as exciting as those 3, but alas, the home streak number 1 upsets is finally over, he said. Mahomet Village Board. Development agreed for new hotel approved. The Village Board has approved a development agreement for a new hotel to be built in Southeast Mahomet. Village Administrator Patrick Brown said the board voted 5-0 to approve the incentive agreement with local company Tabling Development at its Tuesday meeting. Tabling Development previously announced plans to build a new upper-mid-scale franchise hotel with 71 rooms as part of its 10-acre Prairie View Commons development at the northeast corner of Prairie View Road and U.S. 150. They tentatively expect to break ground in spring 2025, and managing partner Sean Tabling said in a previous interview that they are targeting a summer 2026 opening. Under the approved development agreement, the incentives that include partial reimbursement for tax increment financing revenue generated by the development, plus business district and hotel motel tax rebates, with the stipulation that these incentives will not exceed $1.5 million. The agreement also requires Tabling Development to enter a franchise agreement to have the 3-story hotel operate as a Country Inn and Suites by Radisson or another mid-scale national franchise hotel brand to be approved by the village. Brown noted that there were a couple of slight changes from the original draft, including a language update to clarify that the developer must sign a 20-year franchise agreement. Additionally, the project budget, previously stated to be $10 million to $12 million, is now set at $11 million to $12 million in the document. Brown added that the board also voted Tuesday to approve a conditional use permit upon annexation for a new solar development on land in Hensley Township, with a vote split 4-1. Additionally, Toby Willard was appointed to fill a vacancy on the village board, as trustee Rebecca Preston has moved outside the village limits, he said. One person hospitalized after house blaze. One person was taken to an area hospital for treatment from a residential fire in West Champaign Wednesday afternoon. The victim was treated at the scene before being transported to the hospital. Firefighters responded to a home in the 600 block of English Creek Court at 2:34 p.m. Champaign Fire Department spokesman Randy Smith said fire crews were able to quickly extinguish the fire in the single-family home. Light fire was coming from the front door of the two-story duplex when they arrived, and the occupants were outside. The cause of the fire was determined to be accidental and has been attributed to cooking. No firefighter injuries were reported. Two dogs and one cat were rescued from the home. Grubhub to pay $25 million in deceptive practices settlement. Grubhub Incorporated, an online food ordering and delivery platform, will pay $25 million to settle a dispute over alleged deceptive business practices with the Illinois Attorney General and the Federal Trade Commission, officials said Tuesday. Attorney General Kwame Raoul said he launched an investigation into the 20-year-old operation after receiving dozens of consumer complaints and engaged the FTC on the nationwide settlement. Grubhub tricked its customers, deceived its drivers, and unfairly damaged the reputation and revenues of restaurants that did not partner with Grubhub, all in order to drive scale and accelerate growth. FTC Chairperson Lena M. Kahn said Chicago-based Grubhub, which allows consumers to order delivery from nearby restaurants via drivers contracted with the company, will pay $24.8 million in restitution, while $200,000 will fund the Attorney General's consumer education and enforcement operations. Raoul and Kahn said the investigation found that Grubhub engaged in illegal practices by misleading customers about the cost of delivery and benefits of a Grubhub subscription, deceived drivers about the amount of money they could make, and listed restaurants on its app without their knowledge or consent, and in some cases over their objections. In a statement, Grubhub denied wrongdoing and said the company is committed to openness in its practices, and it cooperated with the FTC in its multi-year review. While we categorically deny the allegations made by the FTC, many of which are wrong, misleading, or no longer applicable to our business, we believe settling this matter is in the best interest of Grubhub and allows us to move forward, the statement said. In addition to the settlement payment, Grubhub said it will make changes to its platform to make it easier for diners to understand fees and better understand what delivery drivers could earn. The settlement also requires Grubhub to immediately remove from its listing any unaffiliated restaurants, Raoul said. Teacher of the Week, Josh McQuaid, Family and Consumer Sciences, Rantoul Township High School. 2 years ago, Josh McQuaid decided to make a career change. For a decade, he was a full-time chef, most of which he spent working for Hendrick House on the University of Illinois campus. Now, instead of serving food to U of I students, he's teaching high schoolers at Rantoul Township High School to cook. 2 years in, he's already making an impact on his school, where he's able to put his skills to use in unique ways. I find my work important because cooking is an essential life skill, and I believe that all students should know how to cook. Students will use the skills they learn in culinary every day and for the rest of their lives. I enjoy being able to teach various ways of making food and helping students explore new and exciting ways to make food they haven't liked or tried before is one of the best perks of the job. I became a teacher because I have always had a passion for cooking. I always wanted to teach and share the passion I have, as well as inspire students to learn how to nourish and take care of themselves. Being in the classroom and sharing my passion in a different way from my previous career has been such an amazing experience. By teaching and mentoring students on how to cook for themselves as well as their families, I can see the immediate impact I am having in their lives and look forward to sharing in their successes later in life. My favorite lesson that I teach is, in my baking essentials class, we do cupcake wars, just like the show. It's always so fun to see how creative the students can be and how they can come up with different designs based on a common theme. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when I am able to have a breakthrough with a student who doesn't want to participate or engage in class. Being able to build a relationship and get to know them allows me to know how best to approach the lessons, and then once they finally get in the lab, you can see that the light go on and they start to ask questions. When they show their initial interest, nothing is better than that. I keep students engaged by, as a new teacher, I have found that the best way to keep students engaged is a positive learning atmosphere. Keeping students engaged in a lesson is always different for every student. Being able to teach in different ways is great advice I received. I think a big factor is that students get to eat whatever they make in class. Something else I'm passionate about is I'm super passionate about culinary experiences and travel. Whenever traveling to a new place, I always want to try local food to help immerse myself in local culture. I have been to Israel, the Dominican Republic, Canada, as well as 20 out of 50 states. It's always fun to try food that is special to a place and plan on traveling abroad with my wife in the future. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was Valerie Benz from BHS Culinary Arts. When I was in high school, I attended a dual credit program at Bloomington Area Career Center attached to Bloomington High School. She was such a fantastic teacher and a wonderful mentor to me. If I weren't a teacher, I would be cooking as a career. I do miss working in kitchens with a close-knit group of people day in and day out, but I love teaching even more. I was looking forward to this movie, 6888. I just finished reading the book, but here's Chuck Kaplinsky's screening room. Week 6888 fails to honor courageous women. The 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion were faced with a seemingly impossible task. Dispatched in Glasgow, Scotland in February 1945, the 885 women in the group were charged with sorting and delivering a massive backlog of mail. It had been brought to the attention of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt that letters written by the loved ones of servicemen were not being delivered, and missives from troops were not reaching home. This contributed to low morale in the soldiers, while causing undue stress and worry for their families and friends. Upon arrival, the women and their commanding officer, Captain Charity Adams, were shown airplane hangars filled with rotting mail bags, some of the letters and packages within having sat there for over 2 years. In total, it was estimated there were 17 million pieces of mail. Some had only first names on the addresses, others simply had nicknames. Envelopes with troopers' ID numbers and nothing else were found, while multiple missives and common names like John Smith only added to the confusion. The all-black battalion was set up for failure. Having to endure multiple incidents of overt racism, they were forced to work in a dilapidated old school that had no adequate heat or adequate quarters. They were told they had 6 months to complete the seemingly impossible task. They finished in less than 90 days. This is a fantastic story and deserves a worthy film to be made of it. Unfortunately, Tyler Perry's The 6888 isn't it. Mawkish and heavy-handed, the movie is a throwback to the simplistic, fact-based features made in the 30s and 40s, those in which the characters are drawn in broad strokes and the sentiment is applied with a trowel. There isn't a moment in the movie that isn't telegraphed or handled with tact, while some questionable choices come off as ridiculous rather than poignant. Taking a page from the Schindler's List, Perry begins the film with a blood-stained letter being taken off the body of a dying pilot in San Pietro, Italy, in December 1943. This envelope is the through line to the movie, as we will see it travel, get mislaid and finally discovered amidst the millions of other pieces of mail, log-jammed in Western Europe. It's being written by Abram David Greg Sulkin, a young Jewish pilot who has penned the letter to his girlfriend, Lena King, Ebony Obsidian, back in Bloomfield, Pennsylvania. He dies in action, and of course, she never gets the letter. She eventually joins the Army, only to be assigned to the 6888th. Guess who finds the letter in a rundown Scottish school over 2 years later? Again, this approach may have worked in a World War II propaganda film, but it doesn't hold water here. Neither do the broadly drawn characters, nor a ham-fisted approach to the romance between King and David. Scenes in which he appears in hallucinations to her come off as laughable. The sentiment produced in these scenes is on par with what you might expect from over-earnest actors in a high school play. Even the usually reliable Kerry Washington comes off as wooden as the officious Captain Adams. To be sure, Perry's intentions are sound, as all these women endured and their incredible accomplishments should be recognized. However, this broad, simplistic approach does them a disservice. The lack of genuine sentiment in the 6888 results in a weak tribute to the woman who pulled off a Herculean task. Shutdown threatened as budget bill collapses. President-elect has told House Speaker to scrap current proposal. President-elect Donald Trump abruptly rejected a bipartisan plan Wednesday to prevent a Christmastime government shutdown, instead telling House Speaker Mike Johnson and Republicans to essentially renegotiate days before a deadline when federal funding runs out. Trump's sudden decision to make new demands sent Congress spiraling as lawmakers are trying to wrap up work and head home for the holidays. It leaves House Speaker Mike Johnson scrambling to salvage a new plan days before Friday's deadline to keep the government open. Republicans must get smart and tough, Trump and Vice President-elect J.D. Vance said in a statement. The President-elect made an almost unrealistic proposal for a continuation of government funds, along with a much more controversial provision to raise the nation's debt limit, something his own party routinely rejects. Democrats decried the GOP revolt over the stopgap measure to keep federal offices running. House Republicans have been ordered to shut down the government, said House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries, and hurt the working-class Americans they claim to support. You break the bipartisan agreement, you own the consequences that follow. Already the bill was on the verge of collapse as hard-right conservatives and Trump's billionaire ally, Elon Musk, rejected the plan. Rank-and-file lawmakers decried the massive 1,500-page bill over its increased spending, which includes their first pay raises in more than a decade, a shock after one of the most unproductive, chaotic sessions in modern times. A number of Republicans were waiting for Trump to signal whether they should vote yes or no. This should not pass, Musk posted on his social media site X in the wee hours of Wednesday morning. The outcome comes as no surprise for Johnson, who, like other Republican House speakers before him, has been unable to convince his majority to go along with the routine needs of federal government operations, which they would prefer to slash. Even the addition of much-needed disaster aid, some $100.4 billion in the aftermath of Hurricanes Helene and Milton, and other natural calamities that ravaged states this year, plus $10 billion in economic assistance for farmers, failed to win over the budget-slashing GOP. It all shows just how hard it will be for Republicans next year as they seize control of the House, Senate, and White House to unify and lead the nation, and it underscores how much Johnson and the GOP leaders must depend on Trump's blessing to see any legislative package over the finish line. What does President Trump want Republicans to do? Vote for the CR or shut down government. Absent direction, confusion reigns, said retired Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, in a sly post on X. The president-elect had yet to weigh in on what the lawmakers should do. But Musk, who is heading the new Department of Government efficiency, and leading the charge against it, warning that any member of the House or Senate who votes for this outrageous spending bill deserves to be voted out in 2 years. It's not an idle threat coming from Musk, the world's richest man who helped bankroll Trump's victory and can easily use his American PAC to help or break political careers. Democratic Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland said this is the problem with an oligarchy. A handful of wealthy people run everything, and everyone is supposed to live in fear of them, and their wealth becomes an instrument of coercive power over everything. Democrats who negotiated the final product with Johnson said Senate GOP leadership will be expected to provide enough support to help Johnson ensure passage, as is often the case on big bills. Federal government funding runs out at midnight Friday. Senate sends defense bill to Biden's desk. The Senate passed a defense bill Wednesday that authorizes significant pay raises for junior enlisted service members, aims to counter China's growing power, and boosts overall military spending to $895 billion, while also stripping coverage of transgender medical treatments for children of military members. The annual defense authorization bill usually gains strong bipartisan support and has not failed to pass Congress in nearly six decades. But the Pentagon policy measure in recent years has become a battleground for cultural issues. Republicans this year sought to tack on to the legislative priorities for social conservatives, contributing to a months-long negotiation over the bill and a fall-off of support in support from Democrats. Still, the bill passed comfortably 85-14, sending it to President Joe Biden. 11 senators who caucus with Democrats, as well as 3 Republicans, voted against the legislation. The bill isn't perfect, but it still includes some very good things that Democrats fought for, said Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, in a floor speech. It has strong provisions to stand up against the Chinese Communist Party here on a national security basis. In the House, a majority of Democrats voted against the bill last week after House Speaker Mike Johnson insisted on adding the provision to ban the military health system from providing transgender medical care for children. The legislation easily passed by a vote of 281-140. Senate Republican leaders argued that its 1% increase for defense spending was not enough, especially at a time of global unrest and challenge to American dominance. Senate Republicans had argued for a generational boost to defense spending this year, but are planning another push for more defense spending once they control the White House and Congress next year. We are currently experiencing the most dangerous national security moment since World War II, said Republican Senator Roger Wicker, who will chair the Senate Armed Services Committee next year. He has pushed for larger boosts to defense spending that would break spending caps that are agreed to in the bipartisan deal to suspend the nation's debt ceiling last year. The legislation provides for a 14.5% pay raise for junior enlisted service members and a 4.5% increase for others. Lawmakers said those were key to improving the quality of life of service members at a time when many military families rely on food banks and other government assistance programs to make ends meet. Justices to weigh Planned Parenthood funding case. The Supreme Court said Wednesday it will consider South Carolina's move to cut off Medicaid funding to Planned Parenthood. The court agreed to take up the state's appeal of a lower court ruling focused on whether Medicaid patients can sue over their right to choose their own qualified provider. The case will be argued in the spring. The South Carolina moved in 2018 to cut off funding to Planned Parenthood. The organization uses Medicaid funding for family planning health services rather than abortions. But Governor Henry McMaster said any public money sent there results in the subsidy of abortion. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, December 19th, 2024. Stay warm this weekend, and I hope you have happy holidays.